This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco orders an expensive remodeling job for the state capitol, and what to do about an army that may be stretched too thin. Joining us today to discuss these topics, from Audio Works in New Orleans, Louisiana, is Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. At our bureau in Chicago, Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education and co-director Immigration Studies at New York University, is in East Hampton, New York. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me just start with you, Mary Frances Berry. You are in New Orleans. The Louisiana Hi. Governor is trying to get her Martha Stewart on and really spend a little over $500,000, $565,000 on remodeling the state office. Is this the right time for that?
Well, it's not the right time. And down here, you know, being down here, it really is a tale of two cities, those who have and those who don't and those who are struggling. And everybody's working hard to trying to put things together all along the Gulf Coast and here in the city. The governor, I understand that they made this contract before the Katrina happened. And they claim that if they don't spend this $564,000, that they'll have to pay it anyway because they already have the contract. But she's damned if she does and damned if she doesn't. In a way, it might be better if she just simply ate it and didn't do it, because she has enough problems now with people saying that she's inept, incompetent, out of touch, and doesn't care, which I'm not sure is absolutely true.
Roland, how do you perceive this? And is this a situation where she really is being taken to task for something she didn't have much of a hand in?
I think it would be she would be an improper steward if she did not use the resources that were budgeted, that were bid out. The point that they made was that they could potentially be sued because it was bid out and they were moving forward. Look, I've covered City Hall. I've covered county government. It's always easier to write these kinds of stories to say, well, in tough budget times, you're spending $500,000 in remodeling an office. But there are practices and procedures. And frankly, had they been sued and spent more money on lawyers' fees, then you would have jacked it up even more so. And so, look, you bite the bullet, you spend the money, you deal with the media stories, us talking about it. But the reality is it was a project that was already moving forward. And so you simply move forward and say, hey, that's just the way it is. And you move on.
Marcelo?
It's another unfortunate footnote, really, to the series of catastrophes that will be known historically as the mismanaging of the Katrina aftermath. So on the one hand, there are these budget considerations and legal considerations that need to be taken into consideration. On the other hand, these cosmetic changes at a time when the state is looking into having to lay off over 20% of the workforce, at a time of deep budget cuts, doesn't look good.
Mary. The bottom line is that probably what she should do, whether there is a contract or not, is simply say no. We won't finish it. If we are sued, we'll have to deal with that, and we'll have to claim that given this crisis, we shouldn't have to pay. We'll make those arguments. In a PR sense, given what's going on down here, that probably would be her best option. But Roland is right. If in the end she ended up paying more because she lost the lawsuit, that would be another story. But at least that would be down the line.
Mary, let me ask you, you're in New Orleans right now. Are people talking about the government in a way that indicates folks are still mad that they haven't gotten what they think needs to happen in New Orleans?
Yes, people are. The mood here is local people did what they could for each other. They did what they could for each other. They helped each other. And people are glad to see each other, the ones who are still alive, and to try to fix this place. But they feel like they were let down by government at all levels, not just the governor, but the federal government. Everybody let them down,
the mayor,
up and down the line. The mayor is sort of like, on the one hand, he talks a lot. Sometimes he's irascible. He wants people to come back, but what are they coming back to? So the mood is that the people here, and I have a place down here, so I spend a lot of time here, and we didn't get as much damage as a lot of people. But the mood is we're all doing what we can do to help each other, but the government just simply is clueless or doesn't care or maybe they think we are a third world country and like it and won't do what they should do, and we can't trust them. The latest thing is the levy board, where the governor seems not to be supporting getting the kind of real serious levy inspections. And some people even wish that we had governors like Edwin Edwards, who are the long line of corrupt governors in Louisiana who ended up going to jail, but at least were efficient.
They were efficient at getting money for the projects. But Roland, let me ask a different take on this whole thing. Mm-hmm. What about the media coverage? You're running the Chicago Defender historical black paper. Has the media sufficiently followed up on Katrina? And is a story like this really that important in the big scheme of things?
Again, the way the game works in the media, it's a hot story when it's on everybody else's front page. But after the first month, 2 months, everything begins to subside, and you still have some reporting out there. You don't have the intensity that you had before because it's not as easy. It's not as an emotional story. You don't have the faces. You don't have the, you know, the horror. You don't have the images. Frankly, for some media people, whether we like it or not, it then becomes a boring story. Might as well go ahead and say that, because that's what folks think. So now it becomes a more bureaucratic story. Now it becomes a process story. And look, Americans don't really like process. We want to see the end result. We want to see the opening of a building. We want to see the opening of stores in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. We want to see the town actually finish being rebuilt and, you know, having the ribbon cutting. But we don't want to go through the hard work beforehand. So that's one of the reasons why you've seen such a change of pace. And so it has been the job of black newspapers, of alternative newspapers, to continue to beat the drum and asking those critical questions, because the national media does move on. What's the story now? What's taking place with the miners? That's the hot story of the day, and that's how the media works. We move on to the next hottest story.
Marcelo, this may be a little bit of a departure, but you are running an immigration studies wing at New York University. A lot of people who I've talked to who are Katrina survivors see themselves as immigrants in a way to new parts of the United States. How does a discipline like immigration studies deal with the fact that you had a really specific culture in New Orleans, and a lot of the people who've left are really committed to keeping that culture alive?
Yeah, in many ways, it's more of a refugee story than an immigration story. Immigrants willingly choose to move to another city, to another state, to another country to pursue their interest. In a sense, what we've seen in the Gulf is really the involuntary movement of people due to these series of catastrophes. First, the destruction of the city, and then these inadequate responses that we've seen throughout. But in many fundamental ways, what we're dealing with here is with the shock of dislocation, the need to find jobs, the need to find stability, the need to get the kids back in school, the need to have some kind of order, some kind of a socially predictable life where returning to the daily routines of lives becomes the fundamental task for the displaced person. So in many ways, it is, in fact, a refugee story. It is a story of people having to move to other cities, Houston, other states, to look for stability.
The word refugee has become so politicized. I don't know if that's what you were going to talk about, Roland.
No, I wasn't. Yeah. I mean, I think that is a point I think Mary Frances Berry may like. There was a meeting in the White House a couple of weeks ago where they assembled all of these folks. Bruce Gordon was there. Donna Brazile was there, and others,
right,
laborers and business, where they were talking about this whole issue of retraining. And you know, I've been driving home that point really the week after the hurricane by saying, look, if you have chronic unemployment, and then you're talking about low skill set, service sector jobs, I said, use the community college system to be able to retrain these folks as plumbers, electricians, drywallers, all the kinds of jobs that are needed right now in New Orleans. And so people will have that skill set. Finally, folks have, you know, after 3 or 4 months, get wild, say, wow, let's use our community college system to do exactly that. See, this is how, in terms of media, how we can push a particular issue or drive a story, because you can talk about rebuilding all day. But the people who were unemployed, the people in the Ninth Ward and other places, if they don't have a skill set, you're back at the same position. And so it's how we redefine this issue as opposed to just rebuild. But you also have to retrain and then put them in a position to be able to get work there or wherever they're living now.
Professor
Barry, and you should know that there is an ongoing story there are changes. I mean, that's why the New Year's Eve celebration was important, with all the people who showed up to say, we're here. That's why all the people who are back with the signs up outside, I'm back and I'm working and I'm doing. There are jobs here. There are lots and lots of jobs, employers with signs up wanting to hire people all over the place. Stores are opening. Even the movie theater in town is planning to reopen. So there is life here. And mm-hmm. there was a big story in the Picayune yesterday where there are something like 165,000 people here as opposed to 75,000, given all those who've come back, and all up and down the coast people are coming back. The ongoing story, but I think the next big story is going to be whether the levees get fixed and what happens by next hurricane season. That's going to be the next big story.
And I'm sure that hurricane season is going to creep up faster than people anticipate.
About 3 months away,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
About 3 months away.
Let me transition to another issue. Katrina, the two big stories, really, of last year were Katrina and Iraq. Now, the question has arisen because of the troop staffing in Iraq of whether or not the Army is large enough. If we're going to engage in multiple conflicts around the world, arguably, the Army just doesn't have enough soldiers. Of the Army's 1 million soldiers, fewer than 400,000 are combat troops, and only 150,000 of those are on active duty. Now, should the Army increase its ranks, or should the U.S. pull out of some of the conflicts that we're engaged in the world? Marcella?
I think this, again, points to the limits of unilateral force in an increasingly global age of conflicts, where we are going to need to increasingly coordinate our security interest, our military presence, the display of force within a multilateral framework with partnerships that will contribute their fair share to the kinds of collective security considerations that we're going to be facing. So here, really, we're talking about two separate set of issues. One is, what is the appropriate number of troops that we should be able to deploy worldwide? And the second issue is, what are the alliances, what are the partnerships, genuine partnerships, we're going to be needing if, in fact, we are to manage multiple conflicts in multiple parts of the world?
Well, I find it interesting we're talking about increasing troop levels when the biggest problem that we've had in the past 6 years has been a lack of adequate diplomacy. I mean, sending in troops is really your last option. Unfortunately, we have become a country, an administration, that chooses to go the military route first rather than diplomacy. And so that needs to be a double conversation, because that's really one of our greatest problems. I know folks are trying to float this whole notion of a draft, and I'm telling you right now, that is not going to happen. If they try to institute a draft in this country again, I think you're going to see the kind of revolt that both parties does not want to see.
There's an absolute limitation on how many people can be persuaded to volunteer for the military service. If you read some of the poignant stories of people who did volunteer, 18 and 19-year-olds and the like, they're doing it because they believe that, in fact, if we have to go over there to fight the Iraqis because they came here on 9/11, which is not true, of course, or they will come here. There are only so many people who believe that, which is why it's so hard to recruit people, no matter how much they pay them, what incentives they give them. So the United States is going to be forced to find some military force somewhere else, that from some other country, that they can use to, in fact, help to go off on these adventures, or we are going to be reduced to trying to use multilateralism and diplomacy more than we have right now.
One last speed round question. This is about undocumented immigrants who are trying to go to college. They can't, under federal law, get financial aid, but now some lawmakers in Congress have developed something called the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act, or the DREAM Act. It would allow undocumented students who arrived before they turned 16 and have lived here at least 5 years to become temporary legal residents and eligible for college aid. With immigration such a divisive topic, does this DREAM Act have a fighting chance, and should it? Professor Barry.
It is not going to pass. It doesn't have the chance of a snowball in hell. And also, the point should be made, there's a lawsuit in California right now from out-of-state American students suing because the University of California admits undocumented students with in-state tuition. And they're complaining, why should people who are undocumented pay in-state when we're paying out-of-state? And there are lawsuits that are being developed in other states that have this. So the bill isn't going to pass. And the problem in the current environment that we have will not, but it ought to. There's something ought to be done because these people are here. They're going to be here. They have potential. We're not going to stop them from coming, and it's in the national interest to educate them.
Marcelo?
I agree. And furthermore, really, these children are not going anywhere. These children, these youth who come to the United States, often not really knowing that they don't have the papers to be in our country. These children are going to grow up to be citizens of the United States one way or another. Let's face it, they're not going anywhere. They're not going back to Mexico. They're not going back to El Salvador. They're not going back to Jamaica. They're not going back to Nigeria. This is really the human face of a failed migration policy. We have hundreds of thousands of undocumented alien children and youth in our schools today, and many of these children are facing very dim prospects as they make the move to college or to the labor market.
Roland, very briefly, what about Mary Frances' point that, you know, black students will say, what about me?
Well, I'm not even looking at it from a perspective of what black students will say. This is indeed what happens. The children are having to deal with the sins of the parents, and that is that illegal immigration. I don't think it's going to pass. You're not going to find huge supporters of illegal immigration in the United States Congress. But again, this is what happens when you have illegal immigration. And so this is the back end. If you don't address the front end, this is the story that we're going to be telling 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now.
All right. In Chicago, we've had Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender. In New Orleans, Louisiana, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, co-director, immigration studies at New York University in East Hampton, New York. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Roy.
Thank you.